Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate. Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
If you wanted to guess at what our future economy will look like, what would you look at in the current economy? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Thursday, July 20th. Good to have you with us. Every month, the Conference Board puts out something called its Leading Economic Index. Sometimes people shorthand it as LEI, or you may hear Leading Economic Indicators. Leading because it's supposed to give us a sense of what's ahead for the economy. And the numbers out today indicate, yet again, that a recession is coming. But that recession hasn't materialized for many months. Historically, the LEI has been a strong predictor of recessions, but it's not foolproof. On the Staring into the Economic Crystal Ball beat today, Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovel looked at exactly what LEI measures and what it doesn't that might be more relevant to today's economy.
Kind of like athlete rankings, the Leading Economic Index crunches 10 different performance stats that hint at future economic activity. Things like consumer expectations, new unemployment applications, and new building permits. Tadevik Sekposyan is with Texas A&M University.
You would know that if people acquired permits, then future economic activity in construction, right, would be coming.
These components were chosen because
when you kind of like throw them against the wall, they tend to start to dip before we officially enter a recession.
But University of Houston economist Dietrich Vollrath says these measures aren't perfect.
It's just the 10 things that looked like they were pretty good at predicting the economy in the past. We don't update the leading indicators every day.
He says especially after a once-in-a-lifetime event like a pandemic, the LEI may not be as predictive as it once was. Analyst Ed Yardeni calls the index half right.
It's overly biased towards goods. It doesn't give services enough due respect, if you will.
Another skeptic, Aisha Imahorolu with the University of Southern California, who says there's been no looming recession.
And we still continue to have very low unemployment rate.
She says while the components of LEI may be useful, the index is losing some of its predictive power. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, the Dow did fine, but tech stocks pushed down the NASDAQ and S&P. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Netflix announced its quarterly earnings yesterday. While revenue came in under expectations, the company also said, with its crackdown on password sharing, it added nearly 6 million paid subscribers last quarter. That's almost three times what Wall Street expected. Marketplace's Christian Schwab has more on that win for Netflix, even if not for viewers, and whether it's likely to spread to other streamers.
Netflix hasn't cracked down on everyone who's password sharing yet. But if you haven't been caught, the company's coming for you. Streaming analyst Dan Rayburn says sharing is tracked through IP addresses, device IDs, and usernames.
Because if you have four, five, six different profiles, chances are you're probably sharing that account with multiple people.
Rayburn says Netflix has been smart by starting slow, so it doesn't alienate its users. And it's also given consumers more pricing options. Tim Hanlon is CEO of the Vertair Group.
I think the arrival of an ad-supported, less expensive tier around the same time of this idea made it a lot more palatable.
Netflix with ads is $6.99 a month. A standard subscription is $15.49. Hanlon says the password sharing crackdown was bound to happen. Until recently, streaming platforms prioritized subscription numbers over profits.
I think, frankly, this is a hangover of unmitigated pursuit of growth.
And since Netflix's experiment has been successful, other platforms are likely to adopt it. Eric Sorensen at Parks Associates says as investors become pickier, media companies are pivoting to a new view.
Password sharing is actually a form of pirated content.
Whether sharing accounts is actually illegal, Soren says that falls into a gray area. But if anyone asks, I plead the fifth. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
When it comes to healthcare, one of the biggest things that can be taken for granted is the assumption that our healthcare providers actually know what's going on with our health based on our medical records. But in reality, that picture is often incomplete. Dr. Ilana Yerkowitz is a primary care physician and an oncologist on the faculty at Stanford Medicine. In her new book, she takes on this very problem. That book is called Fragmented, A Doctor's Quest to Piece Together American Healthcare. Dr. Yerkowitz, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You describe fragmentation as the greatest problem underlying American healthcare. What do you mean by that, and why is it such a big problem?
I define fragmentation as the insertion of gaps into a patient's story by design. Doctors like me are constantly working in a state of missing critical information about our patients and having to make life and death decisions with the absence of that information.
Can you give me an example of how that's shown up in your work?
Sure. So we have hundreds of different electronic medical records, and sometimes those are shared between different facilities, and sometimes they're not. One of my patients could have received care at a healthcare facility literally just up the street from me. But when they transfer from that facility over to my office, I don't always have access to the medical records that were kept there. Even if all the data is in my electronic system, as it stands, our EMRs, or electronic medical records, are extremely disorganized. Mm-hmm. I have to click through multiple tabs, dozens of tabs. There was a study showing that an average ER shift in 10 hours involved 4,000 clicks.
Wow.
And so doctors like me are clicking through tab after tab after tab, trying to piece together data that is scattered throughout the electronic ecosystem.
We've had electronic medical records, EMR, for years at this point. Why is this still an issue?
So when the push from paper records to electronic ones began, yes, over a decade ago, there was no related stimulus to require that the electronic vendors talk to each other. So while we mostly did this successfully, paper records, you know, for the most part, I am not charting on loose leaf paper. I haven't done that in years. There was a push for electronic vendors to communicate with each other to enhance patient billing, but it wasn't actually designed for doctors, other healthcare providers, and patients to organize and access that information and put it together into a meaningful narrative. And so I will say there has been a lot of progress over the last few years. More people are recognizing this as an issue, but we are still nowhere close to a universally shared system of records that is meaningful and easy for doctors like me to use.
You talk a lot in this book about the importance of primary care physicians, the shortage of primary care physicians, and the fact that burnout is causing so many folks to leave the field. Are these hours and all of this digital drama factoring into that?
100%. So surveys show that the number one source of burnout for doctors is bureaucratic tasks. And I want to emphasize that that has stayed true before and during the COVID pandemic. So it is higher in specialties like mine, like primary care, where primary care doctors are tasked with doing the majority of what is needed for a patient's overall health. There was a recent study that came out that said if primary care doctors did everything they were supposed to do in a day, they would be working 26.7 hour days.
You know, you're talking here about, you know, the impact on doctors and the impact on the system and the impact of costs, but most of your book is full of how this impacts patients.
Yes, that is the reason I wrote this book. I write about medical errors and near misses that can happen to patients, and particularly the patients who are less equipped to keep their storylines straight. They, in my view, undeniably receive worse care when the burden is placed on patients and loved ones to stitch the pieces of their medical story together. And then I think the second is those burdens. I tell in the book about a patient who carries around a briefcase with multiple color-coded binders of all of her health information. And they're repeating their medical traumas to multiple new faces and doing the work that they also assume the system should have been doing for them when they should be focused on sickness and healing.
What about solutions? What can we do, or I guess it's kind of regulators or hospitals or whoever else, actually do to fix this problem?
I think there's multiple solutions here. We have the technological capability now to better organize electronic records and connect them. It should be doctors and healthcare workers and patient advocates who are giving input on how the electronic ecosystem is organized. The second thing that I talk about a lot in the book is an investment in primary care. In theory, the primary care doctor is supposed to be the person that does now what the patients are doing, which is being that source of continuity. But there are many, many issues facing primary care. And I say this as a working primary care doctor who loves what I do. That has to do, I would say, primarily with billing and a payment model that pays primary care doctor for these 15 or 30 minute visits with a patient and doesn't pay for anything that is outside that visit, such as sleuthing through electronic charts.
What keeps you in primary care despite all these problems?
I love being the primary point person for my patients over time. And I love being the person that oversees the big picture, not just for a slice or a body part, but overseeing the entirety of their story and helping them big picture for the years ahead.
Dr. Ilana Yerkowitz is the author of the new book, Fragmented, A Doctor's Quest to Piece Together American Healthcare. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Since we have the system we have, Dr. Yerkowitz has a list of questions in her book that patients can use to keep a record of their own healthcare. We have an excerpt on marketplace.org.
Coming up, clearly we're already full. There's a list going and people are waiting.
Sounds like the place to be. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 163 points, just shy of 0.5%, to close at 35,225. The Nasdaq subtracted 294 points, just over 2%, to end at 14,063. And the S&P 500 shed 30 points, 0.2%, to finish at 4,534. Despite all those new Netflix subscribers Kristen told us about, the streaming service's shares dimmed 0.8%. We'll hear more a little bit later in the show about the business of women's soccer, but for now, 40 wins, 6 ties, and just 4 losses. That 80% winning record in the World Cup belongs to the United States women's national team, the reigning champions. Bond prices fell, the yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.85%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. The shortage of mental health care providers in this country affects everyone. But in Native American communities, the need is particularly acute. According to the CDC, American Indians and Alaska Natives have disproportionately higher rates of serious psychological distress compared to other groups. But for many in this community, finding a therapist who understands their culture can be challenging, if not impossible. One Texas group is working to fill that gap and train staff to address mental health concerns before they become a crisis. KERA's Elena Rivera has more.
In Dallas, a clinic called Texas Native Health has been serving the state's indigenous population for more than 50 years. It serves any enrolled tribal member for healthcare appointments. But over the years, the clinicians there noticed a greater need for mental health services.
We're only human beings. We can only handle so many things at any given point.
That's Chris Logan, who's Choctaw and part of the clinic's behavioral health team.
And yeah, we may need someone to talk to.
The clinic is expanding mental health services, individual counseling appointments, trauma therapy, and group sessions. The clinic calls those meetings the healing circle.
That's one of the big things about group therapy is that it helps bring that sense of, I'm not alone anymore. I don't have to carry this burden by myself.
Texas Native Health is one of more than 70 urban health clinics across the country that specifically serves indigenous communities. But it's the only one of its kind in Texas. Nationally, about 70% of Native Americans live in urban settings. Dora Brott Pliny, who's Standing Rock Sioux, says the clinic has been her safe place since 1971.
It's where I found my place to heal myself mentally. And I still come to this day.
Brott Pliny originally started therapy to process the abuse she experienced at a Native American boarding school as a kid. But initially, therapists and psychiatrists just didn't have a clue how to treat her. When she came to the clinic, she finally felt understood.
They know our history. They're familiar with it, if not have lived it or lived through it, because there's generational trauma that all of us are healing from. So it is very important. This center has saved me so many times.
Native Americans have higher rates of suicide, substance use disorder, and PTSD than other groups. According to a paper by Harvard professor Joseph Gahn, that's because of the legacy of colonization in the U.S. But some therapists might not be trained to look at the root causes.
Generational trauma, the experience of poverty, unemployment, discrimination.
That's Saida Jessman, associate professor at University of North Texas at Dallas. She leads mental health awareness trainings with different groups, including Texas Native Health.
If someone doesn't know these things, it is unlikely that the care will be provided with respect.
The latest data from the American Psychological Association shows more than 80% of the psychology workforce is white. Only 0.13 identify as American Indian or Alaska Native. That's not even 0.5%. Chris Logan, the counselor with Texas Native Health, says most culturally specific care tends to be offered on tribal lands. So folks travel from all over the state to meet with Native counselors like him in the city.
So many Native Americans either live away from reservations or don't have resources to go back to reservations to see a therapist. And so we are here to help provide services for people that can't make that journey.
He says his favorite part of his work is helping clients process things that have been holding them back for years, even decades.
And that's probably the greatest reward, is just seeing them take that step and having the, well, having the confidence in themselves that, hey, yeah, this is my past, but I want my present and future to be different.
Dora Brotplenty was in her 20s when she first came to this clinic. Now, in her 70s, she openly talks about her experience, so younger folks in the Indigenous community know they can reach out for support.
There's something about us that we, within ourselves, are strong, but we've got to be able to find the help.
She says there's still more healing to do, but she's glad Texas Native Health will be there along the way. In Dallas, I'm Elena Rivera for Marketplace.
The biggest women's sports event on the planet kicked off earlier today in Australia and New Zealand, the quadrennial Women's World Cup of Soccer. The U.S. team is aiming for a fifth world championship and a third in a row, that specific achievement being something no team has ever achieved, men or women. Our first match in the month-long competition is tomorrow against Vietnam, and this year, the Women's World Cup is simply bigger. There are more teams, 32 up from 24, likely playing for more viewers, both in the stands and watching on screens around the world. There's also more money, marketing and sponsorship deals, newly pumped up broadcast rights, and higher guaranteed income for the players. As Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, all this reflects just how much the women's game is growing.
A little over a week ago, the U.S. women's national team played a friendly against Wales, an exhibition warm-up for the World Cup. And the buzz for the main event was already building at the Sports Bra, a women's sports bar in Portland, Oregon. Jenny Nguyen is the owner.
Clearly, we're already full. There's a list going, and people are waiting. But that's pretty common for us on a game day.
Beer was flowing, the match was playing on five big screens, and it was hard to miss the enthusiasm for women's soccer.
The United States, one of seven countries to appear in every tournament.
And so now people are seeing, like, oh, if you put it on TV, people will watch it.
AJ Griffin had joined the crowd in a soccer jersey. She used to play competitively. Now she more often watches.
They're incredibly talented players. I really think that if people just gave it a chance, started watching it more, that it would elevate the game.
We do see far more women's sports than we ever have before.
Ellen Storowski teaches sports media and gender at Ithaca College.
But at the same time, women are still just getting less than 1% of sport marketing dollars globally. What is it going to take financially in terms of media coverage to actually see women's sports at 20%, 25%?
Women's soccer is taking one small step in that direction. This year, for the first time, soccer's global sanctioning body, FIFA, negotiated the women's broadcast rights separately from the men's. In the past, FIFA offered broadcasters both for one fee, and the men got the lion's share of the money. What's more, says Storowski?
To approach marketing and broadcasting of women's events as being add-ons of men's sports rather than as the main event. The industry has actually been leaving money on the table.
FIFA hasn't disclosed how much broadcasters paid for the Women's World Cup, but says media analyst Paul Verna at Insider Intelligence,
it's still fractional compared to what they get for the Men's World Cup.
Still, the new revenue and the precedent of selling rights to the women's tournament will make a difference, says Richard Motzkin. He's at sports marketing agency Wasserman, which represents nearly a dozen U.S. World Cup players.
Investment has improved, both in terms of the sheer number of companies who are putting money behind the female soccer players, but also in terms of what they're being compensated. Now you've got the broadcasters putting more time and attention behind the tournament as well.
But soccer still faces a huge gender gap, says Paul Verna at Insider Intelligence.
The women just are not anywhere on the same level in terms of the licensing revenue for the broadcast rights as the men. In fact, they're orders of magnitude below.
Just compare what the U.S. pro soccer leagues get for their games.
Apple just paid $250 million a year for 10 years for the rights to the MLS, the men's soccer league. The women's rights, the last time they were negotiated, which was only 3 years ago, went for $1.5 million. So that's a multiple of 166.
And it means fewer women's matches on TV with fewer bells and whistles, says Ellen Storowski at Ithaca College.
If we're not broadcasting all of the games, if the quality of those broadcasts is not up to par to create excitement, there is no way that we're going to have an audience that's going to be following it, right?
And she says that means it'll take even longer to boost pay, improve facilities and training to reach par with the men. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today about how we make money move through this economy. The Federal Reserve announced today that its new system for instant payments is now live. The FedNow service allows banks and credit unions of all sizes to instantly transfer money to customers anytime, any day. So that means access to your paycheck can happen as soon as it's deposited rather than waiting for business hours or waiting several days for cash transfers to settle. For what it's worth, other countries like Brazil, India, the United Kingdom, as well as the entire European Union, have had systems like this in place for years. No time for economic context today, but, you know, that's what the whole show was for anyway. The Marketplace editing staff includes John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek. Amir Babawi is the managing editor, and I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.